listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys over here on my right. We've got Martin Page.
Hey, Mikey.
And next in, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello, Mike.
And next to Scott, we got Bobby Sommerfeld.
Hello, Mike.
Next to Bobby, we got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
And next to Andrew, we've got Rob Arbatier.
Hello, Mike.
That was very good.
Thank you.
Could you do that again, Rob?
You guys make such fun of me for saying it that way. Ooh, I sound rich tonight. That's nice.
Very mellow.
You've got that broadcast voice today.
I got the magic microphone tonight.
Ooh. Mm, he does.
Well, anyhow, yes.
Yeah, let's move on.
Take your hand off of Mike's knee.
You know what? That was definitely the best intro we've had yet.
Cool.
Not really.
All right. See you next time.
Thank you and good night.
Anyhow, guys, I want to start the podcast off by just mentioning a few things. Number one, I got to go a little tech on you. A couple weeks ago, I was preaching the virtues of Soundtrack Pro. And I said that you could not move a QuickTime, which is one bug, but I found another bug that was really annoying me. And in Soundtrack Pro 2, if you edit a bunch of edits together, I went to go bounce them to disk, and it bounced everything except the last region. It would just never go.
Soundtrack Pro's been out like 2 weeks.
No, it's been out for longer than that.
Oh, but 3 weeks.
But maybe they misspelled it. Maybe it's Soundtrack Pro.
It's like,
but here's the thing, okay?
Soundtrack 2.01.
That's what
but,
it is.
But the reason why I'm bringing this up is then I went to the website and you look in the discussion forum and you just see all these complaints about people just having all kinds of problems with it. And a lot of people are saying, you know, did they ever test this? Did they ever, you know, run this through any audio professionals? Did they ever try to do any real editing on this? And it just got me thinking about, you know, audio programs in general. And first thing I wanted to ask you guys is, A, have you guys ever had any really bad experiences with any of the stuff that you may be involved with testing yourselves? And what kind of process, I mean, is it really extensive? Do you think Apple really did an extensive process as far as testing this in real world situations?
Are you asking us? I hope you're not asking this because this could be a whole podcast. And
no, but just
one application.
Just, yeah, have we ever had software that hasn't worked correctly?
No. I'm just saying, in your own personal experience, how extensive do you think the testing was done on this? I mean, this is all speculation. This could be on, but a lot of you guys here, I know, you know, beta test a lot of software. And when you beta test it, do you run it through as many different, combinations and different problems as you possibly can?
It's always a fine line because you try to, in the later part of the beta test, when it's getting close to release, you start to use it for real work.
Right.
But you're always, if you are doing real paying work, you're always a little bit nervous about using beta software for something that's critical. And with all the zillions of pieces of software I've tested over the years, I have tested some applications that had trouble, like they'd have bugs in their saving algorithms. So then all of a sudden you'd think you were saving things and you weren't, or things weren't being recalled back properly. And if you have a bug like that in
it's
a piece
good.
Of software, you don't want to be using it for real work, and it's a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to speculate on Apple's testing policy, but okay, let's
They
do
obviously
it.
Must test the stuff pretty extensively.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering some of the complaints.
Well, but different companies have different theories on how far they go outside the company to test. I mean,
sure.
And that's like, you know, people in this room even throw around the Pro Tools killer phrase quite often about software that's going to come out. Yeah. And I think the one thing that DigiDesign has always been really good about is external beta testing.
That's true.
They test with hundreds of people doing everything. And they don't just test people with the big HD rigs. There are tons of people on M-Powered and LE testing everything.
Right.
And that stuff comes out pretty proven. I mean, you know, every once in a while some bugs will get past that are, you know, how could you possibly have missed that? But not that often.
No, I mean, that's true, and you have to look at the workflow where they're putting Soundtrack Pro into the whole using it with Final Cut Pro, and it's supposed to be a complementary program as opposed to the program, but still doing some simple things, you know, because I was working on an edit, and I wanted to bounce the soundtrack down, and I wanted to get a file that I could move into Motion, and it just wouldn't do that last one. I'm just thinking, did anybody try to do anything with this thing?
Pro Tools 7 and Pro Tools 5. The first time a major, major overhaul of a piece of software comes out,
right,
it's always buggy. It's always buggy, and then you wait for the 701 or 702 or 7.1.
Well, as long as it's bugs that don't destroy your project. If they're just inconveniences, I think everybody's pretty used to that.
Remember when the new Mac operating system came out, and then anyone had the FireWire 800, it erased?
Yeah, that was bad. It would just erase your hard drive.
And a week later, you know, the fix came out for all those people that wanted to rush.
Wait, what happened if you had a FireWire
800? Right?
It would just kill it.
It would basically just erase the drive. Whatever you had was gone.
It destroyed the directory, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And the emails. I think what's important for people to do those within those chat rooms and websites is when you're looking to upgrade into something, especially if it's brand new.
Right.
Is to check it, see what other people. There's something called the bleeding edge.
Yeah.
And it's truly the bleeding edge, you know. Mm. And some of the Lacy drives, everyone said, yes, we're going to buy the terabyte drives. And everyone forgot to realize there's four drives in there that are almost built in an array. And when one drive fails, you lose all of it. Wow. You cannot restore it. Lacy can restore it. You're screwed. So what happened was I was looking to go buy some drives. And all of a sudden, boom, on the Sound Designers forum at Yahoo, hundreds of messages started coming up going that one by one, all these drives were collapsing, and everyone started bailing, backing up their stuff. Because especially in the sound effects world, it's not uncommon to have 2 terabytes of material sitting around. And if that stuff you've collected all your life, and there's no backup tape that you're going to do that any single person at the home can afford – you know, so we all started buying extra terabyte drives or 500s, 2500s, 750s, whatever. I started backing the stuff up on the other drives. And it's really important because if you lose it or with songs, you're screwed. If you don't have 2 or 3 copies and you don't turn those drives on all the time, you know, if you haven't turned it on in a year and you turn it on thinking that's your backup.
And it's gone.
It may be gone.
Yeah. Well, I guess the whole lesson of this whole thing is that go read the boards on Apple's website. Yeah.
I tell you something. I think the lesson is not to be on the bleeding edge because I think that's actually a waste of time these days.
It is.
Yeah.
I used to love doing it, but I've
you don't need to anymore, though.
Yeah, I find I'm doing less of it myself. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, when you for myself, I'm working on a project. I'm working in Final Cut Studio. It's I don't know. I wish it would have been a little more polished.
Is the application you're using? It's got features that you can't find anywhere else.
No, I can, but for just convenience and the fact that I could, you know, do the edit and actually the edit's already done and you know, I can redo the edit. That's not a problem. But sometimes, you know, when you
and it's a Macintosh app, right?
Yeah,
I'm a proud new Macintosh owner.
Hey! Welcome to the family.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Are you gonna buy the phone?
No, not yet. Not the first 18 months. it's a beautiful, I mean, it's a lovely, beautiful interface, and it's just so friendly to look at. It's lovely. It's like, nice coming home. I've been a Macintosh user for 18 years or so. But again, that's, you know, they've run this great, beautiful looking OS, but yet the mail service is very basic. That their little mail application is very basic. Safari is unfinished. It's like I'm thinking, God, you know what? It looks really good, but really,
you know, using Firefox.
Use Firefox. That's what I use.
Exactly, Firefox. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm thinking, God, you know, it's a shame. You know, it's like it's
close.
It's close. You
close,
know?
But
it's 10.4.10 now. So you think they must be getting it together by now?
But you know, also a bad thing about the people that are on the bleeding edge, and I found this with myself, especially when I was doing a lot of beta testing. You get a piece of device, whether it's hardware, or software, especially on computers. And what you do is you realize that, yes, it's buggy, and you find ways around it, whether not to do certain keystrokes, not to go certain speed, or whatever the dynamics are. You just learn, if I do this, it'll crash, so I don't do this. What happens, though, is you get so used to doing something a certain way that by the time they get the bug fixed, and it's sometimes 3 generations later, you're still doing the same kind of work, and somebody goes, hey, look, and you go, what'd you just do?
You know, there have been so many times.
Wait a minute. I thought that crashes the system. And they're like, I don't know what you're talking about.
That happens to me all the time. I'll call Andrew with a Pro Tools question, and he'll tell me how to do something. And I'll say, well, I used to try to do that, and it didn't work. And he'll say usually, well, they fixed that 35 versions ago. But, yeah, you get these workarounds going in your brain, bad habits, which is really pretty silly because the manufacturer is the one – who's doing the stuff wrong, and the user ends up having to figure out the workaround.
I'll tell you a funny one. Steinberg, they came out with a VST 4.0. So me, like an idiot, go off, yeah, I'm going to buy it. I stuck it in my Mac Quadro, I think it was. It was great. I was sitting there, you know, grooving away with this new application. I thought, oh, this is going to be brilliant. Loaded it all up. Everything seemed to be working fine. I pressed play, and it sort of did a little stickery thing, and it played for a minute and then stopped. And I rewound, and it just went near full volume, took my NS10 tweeters right out, blew them.
Wow.
And it did it, you know, I mean, I then switched to my Auratone, so I stopped doing that. And it was a bug, and the 4.1 came out like 2 weeks later.
Nice.
It stopped it. It was a nice little, like, feedback loop. It puts the, I don't know, the audio card into input into output when you go into play.
Did you send him the bill?
It was hilarious.
So I want to file a harassment suit, though, against the internet. Because, like, I had my PC, and it's like, do you want to do Yahoo 8, Messenger 8? I'm like, or I am, and I'm like, no. You want to do Yahoo? You want it? You want it? You want it? You want it? Every time, it keeps popping up. So I said, fine, put it in, boom. Outlook doesn't work. The Messenger takes me offline. And then I'm like, so then I install it? Doesn't work.
You want a PC?
I got PCs and Macs, but on my PC, and I'm kind of like, will you guys just shut up? I don't want the antivirus update. I don't want the Sony update. I don't want the Yahoo update. I don't want the Google update. I just want to do what I do and not spend the next 30 minutes saying no to all the pop-ups.
Yeah, I just upgraded to Internet Explorer 7 on PC, Windows XP. Yeah. Did the same thing. Okay, here we go. Sat there, and of course, Windows in its glory. Anyway, Internet Explorer is like, press it, it's like, wait to get onto the internet. I'm like, hello, what's going on?
That's where the Mac gives you the finger, you know, little thing.
I just deinstalled it, yeah, the beach ball. I'm getting intimately. So I went back to Internet Explorer 6. I was like, okay, I don't know what that's about.
Well, I guess the lesson here is, you know, don't be bleeding edge on anything.
Well, you know what? With Stevie's computers, you know, I have all this non-visual software for him.
Right.
But we do have antivirus, and we have all kinds of applications there. I try to streamline it as much as possible, but all the time, things are popping up on the screen.
It's so hard, right?
And he won't know what's going on exactly. And these things are not part of the normal Windows operating system, so the speech synthesizer can't deal with it. So we now have a standing thing where if the computer doesn't seem to be working right, hit Escape 10 times and then hit Alt-Tab. Because if there's some dialogue on the screen, chances are Escape will make it go away, and then when it comes back, Escape will make it go away again.
Right.
And if it's actually taking the focus away from Cubase, whatever application he's running, Alt-Tab will switch him back.
Oh, that's cool.
But it's a nightmare, and you know, for a non-visual user, it's really a nightmare.
So here's the question for you guys, because it's an important one. Mike keeps going. We've got to change the subject. Now, with all of these things, you've got your Pro Tools, your Logic, whatever, the audio computer. It's obviously not a good idea to put all of the AOL and Yahoo and all that crap on your music computer.
Never.
Oh, heck no.
Never.
No. No, there's no good reason to put that stuff on a music computer. It'll only slow it down. And if you go and look at the actual resources of the computer, the music software is hardly using any of the power and all these other
And everything's going, I might need to look for an update, so we need to...
There's a cool thing in Windows. You can just switch off the internet completely. You just disable it in the control panels and just switch it off so it doesn't even poll it. Same with if you're on the Mac as well, if you're using the AirPort, just go and disable that. That's a big hog.
Yeah, the system I mix on every day isn't even connected to the internet. Yeah. We do all our updates with flash drives. And never ever get
out. So you're not networked? Not on a network?
Well, I'm on a network, but I'm not on the internet. Hey, last time on the last podcast, I told you about the fantastic flameout that I had with the demo that I did with the president of a company and the manager of this project I'm working on, and how it just did not work. Well, I want to give you guys an update. 2 days later, I still hadn't fixed the problem. And I had a meeting with them at 8 p.m. And it reminded me of being on the road, because you know on the road that when you pull into that venue, no matter what happens that day, when you roll in at 8 o'clock, you know at 9 o'clock the show's going to go on. It's going to happen. There may not be any stage up there. You may not see any lighting, but you know at 9 o'clock that night the show's going to go on. Well, it was a similar thing. I had this meeting at 8 o'clock, and I didn't know how it was going to happen, but I knew somehow that night this thing was going to work. So to make a long story short, we had the meeting at 8 o'clock. It didn't work. And then I just got – I just stopped for a second, and I thought maybe the machine was getting confused, and you can program little sequences in it. And so what I did was I took a big sequence, and I broke it down into a bunch of small sequences. And sure enough, the machine came to life, and it worked. And it was like total triumph, total victory. I felt like it was like being on the road again and solving a problem right before showtime. And so I want to bring up, last week we did Fantastic Failures. I want to hear some stories of some triumphs. Anybody have any stories where either someone's come through for you or you've come through where things have just, you know, all the planets aligned and you know, it's worked? Anybody?
I've got one for you.
All right.
Since carrying on with the theme from last year, last week, I used to live in South Africa, and obviously it's a third world underdeveloped country in most areas where we played. I was working with a band called Jaluka, and we played at these little rural places and out in the bush. And we went out there, and the promoter says, "Yes, come on, bring the band in, you know. We've got electricity." And he had this generator, which was not much better than, I swear, I've got a bigger one at home right now for an earthquake. It's like 60 watts, I swear. So we couldn't run anything on it. So I said, is there any electricity out here? And it was a development, you know, the place is just like a grid. It hadn't been built pretty much except for this hall and a church. There you go. Anyway, so they had this lamppost that was going to be there. They had the four pole bolts sticking out the ground all along the street, but there was electricity on every like eighth one. So there's electricity in this lamp thing. So we basically gypoed this thing. We opened it up. We paralleled a bunch of extension cables, and there was 380 volts in there. We wired in there and ran a PA on this very hot extension cable. But it was about four of them together, and it was like everybody's, yeah, electricity. It was really pretty cool.
And you did that without? Could you shut the electricity off the pole?
No, they had to keep it on. But you just, as long as you don't touch them both at the same time.
The thing was, you were told by the tribe that you would be killed unless you made this happen.
I was in the pot at the time, actually. They let me reach out the pot.
When the natives start licking you, you know, you're like,
God. That's so wrong.
It's pretty hilarious.
Wow, that's gutsy, man.
Yeah, hey.
There's one thing I hated to mess around with was always the electrical, you know. And you see those guys getting the pigtails into the plates.
Yeah.
And they're just like, pink, pink. And you're like, holy crap.
You know, there's a trick, actually. If ever you're doing that, if you ever have wiring live, put your left hand in your left pocket so that if you touch it and you go down the ground, the electricity goes down your right hand because you'll be using your right hand to fiddle.
And it won't go through your heart.
It will go through you and it'll bypass your heart muscle and go down your leg. So it'll burn these nerves and not kill you.
Just useful.
And another one actually is to bend your legs. Because what happens is the moment you get a shock, it takes all the muscles and expands them.
Yeah, it contracts. So you never want to grab.
So what happens is your legs will straighten out and theoretically will toss you away from
Save Your Life podcast. Yeah.
Pretty hilarious. Shall answer series of audio.
I used to have straight hair though before I did that.
Rob, any moments of triumph? Come on.
I have, well, actually two come to mind, and one of them has to do with power. But the first one is actually the story I told last podcast about crawling on the floor trying to get a Lin 9000 to boot with Ray Charles.
Yes.
I'll reset the stage. At the Kennedy Center Honors, they're honoring Ray Charles. It's actually a very famous concert. They used it after Ray Charles and Reagan had died close to around the same time, because there were shots then of Ray Charles on stage with Ron and Nancy Reagan watching him from the audience. And what I said last time is if the camera had panned out a bit, you would have seen me in a tuxedo crawling on the floor trying to get a Lin 9000 to boot with a stack of boot floppies. I mean, I must have had 15, 20 of these floppies in my hand because they used to fail constantly. And disc after disc, I couldn't get the Lin 9000 to boot. And Ray Charles was finishing his song. I'm crawling on my knees. I look up. I see President Reagan and all these dignitaries in the audience. And I'm thinking, I am about to destroy the show because they're about to introduce Stevie Wonder. And he's going to come out and he's going to have to, like, you know, play the piano like a bongo because the Lin 9000 isn't going to be able to play. There's not going to be any track to play to. And right as they introduced Stevie, the Lin booted. I mean, right at that moment, I must have tried 50 times, and just then it worked. And I knew never to give up with the thing, because the Lin was like that. It would just, sometimes it would take 50 tries. And it was still better than when you used to have to use cassettes to load your song. But so, I guess God was smiling on me, because right at that moment, they introduced Stevie, the Lin booted. I didn't even get a chance to tell him that it was working. He just came out and hit play because it used to be on the stage with him.
Right.
And I just crawled off in my tuxedo, and I just remember sitting on the side of the stage just sweating and panicking.
And becoming very religious.
Yeah, that was really bad. Mm. But it did have that happy ending. The other story that had a happy ending was a different Stevie tour. We were in Singapore, and it was another Stevie concert, and they were having all kinds of power problems with the show. And they said they had generators out behind the venue, and it was a big place. It was like 20, 25,000 people, and they couldn't get the power right. We couldn't get power for audio, couldn't get power for lights. Everything was completely messed up to the point where they were ready to cancel the show. And they had even told Stevie, don't leave your hotel because we don't think this is going to happen. And I remember Stevie's brothers and all the tour personnel, everybody was basically writing it off. And Mick Parrish, who was the equipment manager, right, asked me, you think there's anything you can do? And I said, well, I have no idea, but let me go take a look. And I went around back, and they had a whole bank of generators, but they were all different sizes. And they had all the electrical lines that fed all the different parts of the stage and the lights and the sound and everything else. And I actually figured out which line went to which part and figured out who needed the most juice and who needed the least. And I basically redid all the generators so that the things that needed a lot of power got it, and the things that didn't need much were okay too. And I got all the generators running with the local crew just standing there watching me. I mean, I was like a crazy person. I didn't know what I was doing. I was never in charge of the AC.
None of the street lights, though.
No street lights. But I don't know. Maybe, I mean, the audience was already coming in. They hadn't canceled the show yet, but they were going to.
Right.
And about an hour before showtime, I got all the power stuff working, and it was really just luck. I mean, I think I looked like I knew what I was doing, but I was a bit terrified because I knew if this works, I'm going to be the hero. But if this doesn't work, then it's completely my fault that the show was canceled. And there's not going to be any way for me to explain to anybody that it wasn't my fault. And just about an hour before showtime, everything lined up and worked fine. And once again, the whole show, I just sat on the side of the stage hyperventilating.
You know, the funny thing is the show truly always does go on.
Yeah. This one was real close to being canceled, but it did go on.
Scott, any last minute?
I mean, for me, anytime a movie has CG in it, especially lots of it, I'm always dance this dance. And one of the dances was years ago I did a movie called Godzilla. And it's the day before I was working on the babies, and the babies were coming. I mean, literally we were getting versions by the hour.
The baby Godzillas.
The baby Godzillas, yeah. The
midwife.
The midwife, yeah, the babies were coming. And, you know, the whole thing was, it took us a long time to figure out how to get the Godzilla sound. And I kind of came late in the game. Another designer was working on it, and it didn't work. So I had 4 weeks to do the whole movie from scratch and to create it and figure out how they created the Godzilla sound. And, you know, a week and a half of it was me sweating, going, I'm really close, but I'm not there. And, you know, praying a lot. So anyway, there was one section where I see the scene, and it's a big open ballroom. And, I don't know, the main characters come, and they look at it, and they kind of look down. And there's, like, one or two little babies, Godzillas. They kind of look up at him. And it didn't feel right. They went, oh, and then they ran off. So I called them up, and I said, so, What happens in the scene? So they said, don't worry about it. You know, there'll be a couple more babies, and then, you know, they'll kind of look at them and they'll run off. I said, oh, okay, great. So I put a couple sounds, you know, 3-4 babies in there, and they kind of looked up and, you know. So fine. And then they said, okay, well, here's the last version. It mixes tomorrow. So I said, great. So I get the tape in. It's already noon, so I don't even have a full day. I take a look at it, and it's like 150 babies. Basically, the whole room is filled with babies, and I'm like, I go, when is this mix? They said, 9 o'clock in the morning tomorrow.
Oh, no.
And I sat there, and I pretty much panicked for a good 30 seconds and just pretty much lost my mind. And then I said, okay, that's absolutely got me nowhere. So I sat there and you know, freaked out and got through it all and made it work. And it was there at 9 in the morning and worked great. But it's scary because you think, like, you know, the more stress you get, the less creative you get. So right. You've got to bring your stress down, even though you're totally freaking out, of how you're going to solve this problem in this stressful situation and still retain a level of creativity. And so anything with CG, I mean, on Chronicles of Riddick, we're print mastering the film. It's done. The film is done. They bring in the last print. There's the CG. We look at it and go, hey, there's a bunch of ships flying over we've never, ever seen before. Okay, stop the mix process. Let's go backwards. And we literally had a stage. It's like $1,300 an hour. Everyone's there. Everyone, we're going to turn into a very large, the most expensive editing room on the planet. Take about 2 hours. We're going to create some more ships. And then we'll start the process all over again. But yeah, and then, you know, they're looking at, are you done yet? Are you done yet? How about now?
That's great. Hey, Andrew.
You sent an email this afternoon saying this is what we're going to talk about. And I've been trying to think of what. I got nothing. I don't know. I mean, I used to fix syncopators for a living.
I'm
so
sure
every single time you fixed one of those, it felt like,
yeah,
oh, my God.
That's a feat in itself.
Somebody's $500,000 piece of gear that wasn't working, and you get it.
I can guarantee there were times on the road when you saved the day and made all of us look good.
Did the syncopators ever overheat at a bad time and you had to find a way to cool them down?
No, because on the tour, we actually had a tent and a 5-ton air conditioner. And I put my hammock right
in front
of it.
Is this MJ's story?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I got nothing.
I don't know. I thought that was pretty good. But, you know, obviously Andrew leads the charmed life. No, that's great. Hey, Martin.
You know, it's a different kind of situation. But when you sent the email through, I remember a time that was very nerve-wracking was when I first came to America. I was working with Earth, Wind & Fire, which was a dream to work with this band, and they were recording live. The whole band was going to play a song that I'd written live. And, you know, I was in the recording studio with them, and they were working the song up, and it wasn't going so well. And it was like, you know, it was, I could feel that the vibe wasn't there. And Maurice White, who was the leader of the band, was having problems with the rhythm section. It sounded pretty good to me, but he wasn't happy with the drums. And so it was a tense time because I could see the song I'd written for them was, after 6 hours of playing, was going to be dropped. And I was sat in the studio with Maurice thinking, oh God, this isn't going to work out too well. You know, here goes my big chance. And I could see that he was concentrating on the drummer, and the drummer was his brother. And Maurice White was I'd read that he was a great session drummer himself. So I remember just talking to him saying, well, you can hear something. Maybe you should play the drums. And it was, you know, at that moment, he just looked at me and said, I'll give it a go. And then the song took off.
Really?
So it was at near, literally the seventh hour, he went through and pushed his brother off the drums.
So you destroyed the family.
The family was destroyed, but
he got
the song.
Which song?
There's a song called Magnetic, which was on an album called Electric Universe, just before they were breaking up, actually. They actually did break up after that.
So now we know why.
There you know. But you know, he was a great session player, and it was really a revelation to see, you know, how he constructed all those feels for Earth, Wind & Fire in the years in the past. Because once he got on the drum kit, you know, I was seeing him for 6 hours as the singer and the arranger. But he sat on the drums, and the song came alive. And his brothers just went to the toilet and vanished. But that was for me, it was a very tense moment because it was a situation where I expect we realize. As producers and songwriters, there's a certain feel you want to get, especially with live players.
Right.
And you could see it evaporating and the energy was going. And then all of a sudden, with one small move, the song came back to life. But that was a tense time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is an amazing phenomenon when you just change one bit of the puzzle
yes.
around. And it's amazing. It really is amazing. And then
the air changes. The whole
everything
vibe
happens.
Changes.
Everything just happens. It's a weird
thing. And all the other players were lifted. You know, it was a new player,
and then all
a new attitude. Everybody
momentum
changed.
Takes over, and you think, we're winning here. And then all of a sudden it does win.
Yeah.
And it's a good tactic, too, because sometimes, like in that case, you actually change the thing that needed changing.
Yes.
But sometimes change something totally irrelevant,
right.
But it will still get people to kind of rethink where they're at and reset.
Totally.
My underpants sometimes.
Well, you should think about that more often.
You can do that, can't you, even with vocalists. You know, they can be singing and you can just change one, you know, light the room up differently, have a 10-minute break or give them a different reverb in the cans and suddenly, bang, it all happens again. It's a very magical process, yeah.
Wow, that's great.
By the way, I do want to say something very important. It's somebody's birthday tomorrow.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's our leader's birthday. Mike Rodriguez is 21 tomorrow.
Yay. Yay.
No, that's just a joke. No, he's not.
All right.
Well, happy birthday, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you for leading us so well.
Who's got his cane for him?
Is this a big birthday? Is this 2019?
Nope, this is one of those that you just go and you let it pass and you keep moving.
Yeah, I just had one of those myself.
When was yours?
Mine was last week.
Happy birthday to you too.
Thank you.
Gracious.
All right. June rules.
That's right, June rules. Of course, this will be posted in July. But June
well, there
rules.
You go. June rules anyway.
I think we should do a birthday bash though when Andrew's got a big one coming up.
No. Have you got a big one coming up?
Yeah, we're not talking about birthdays.
Probably always you. Always you, dragging us down.
All right, we're moving on. But thank you, Martin. That's very kind of you. I wanted to – I've got one story, and I know that Rob and Andrew, you probably can relate. But a moment of triumph was the very first time I took a keyboard apart, not knowing what I was doing.
For no reason at all.
No. I was on the road – well,
take a screwdriver.
Oh, hey, the thing about, you know, when you're on the road, what people understand is if you're the keyboard tech, or a drum tech, or the guitar tech, if anything goes wrong with whatever you're teching, it's your responsibility. I mean, you're going to get it fixed. You're going to either get it fixed or you're going to find a way to get it fixed. I found it to be one of the few jobs where there's like ultimate responsibility. It's your gig. And I was with Al Jarreau and we were in Berlin doing a show and a key broke on one of the keyboards that one of the keyboard players had and it just wouldn't come up. He'd hit it and it wouldn't come up. And so they're all looking at me to fix this thing and I'm like, well, I have no idea how to fix this thing, you know?
So you reharmonize the whole set with a pedal tone.
But, you know, you can just tell and you've got the...
one note has to go through every song with the whole set.
So you reharmonize.
Change the keys now!
Well, so what I did was, you know, everybody's... You know, you get the look from the production manager like, well, fix it, you know? And so I just got the screwdriver out and I'm like, it was a rolling keyboard. And I started taking off the bottom panel and... And, you know, sure enough, I opened it up and I saw the keyboard and, it was basically a spring-based system that had just this little piece of metal that worked as a spring. And when you hit it, it would cause the tension and go back up. And so I thought, well, you know.
Don't do this at home, folks. Yeah.
I got a paperclip. I cut a spring out of the paperclip. I stuck it in there and sure enough, it worked good enough to get through the show and then got back to the U.S. But, you know, sometimes you just got to dig in there and you just got to see what you're going to find.
Good job you had a screwdriver, mate. That's all I can say.
And the other time was I was with Martin and we were doing a really important show at the House of Blues and I was his keyboard tech. And the MPC-60, which had been working perfect all around the world, it was working perfect when we went across the country, decided to die on us at the House of Blues show, which was probably perhaps, you know, the most important show on the whole, the whole thing. And so we
I was looking at you then again, wasn't I?
But I remember it.
Whose job is this, my Rodriguez?
You know what? this is the part you don't know about.
How's it going, Mike? Fine!
That's exactly right. Because, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, no problem. We actually had to rent another MPC-60. We had to bring in another
about
MPC-60.
About an hour before. You didn't work on the sound check.
But what Martin didn't know, and I haven't told you.
You paid a lot of money to do it, and it was taken from my account?
No, that MPC-60 that we rented didn't have the same outputs, wasn't configured the same way as the MPC-60 that we were using. And so I actually had to end up fixing the broken one by just basically doing the same thing, seeing if we can get in there. I forgot exactly what the problem was, but it was on the
because it hasn't
output.
Been working at home.
That's right.
Been stuck in polka mode.
No,
but one note just plays.
But it's also all the water weight in your body. It's because
it has a paperclip jam in it.
No, but I'll never forget that because it was like I just remember when telling Martin, you know, we got everything working.
You were very calm through that. Well, you know, I never saw the tension in your face. Underneath your armpits was a lot of sweat, but I never.
But no, that's about those are like the two standout moments. Anytime you take apart gear, you don't know what the heck you're doing. if you can put it back together and it works, then that's a triumph in it.
I would think that one of the keys as well is you being calm on stage as well, because once that, you know, the panic sets through from the road crew, it's going to go through. You, that must be a skillful thing.
No, that's
well.
True. I mean, yeah. I'm sure Rob and Andrew would agree that half the thing is when you're in that situation.
Like trying to look calm. Part of the key to always looking calm is to be keyboard tech for a blind guy.
Or on drugs.
Right? There you go.
Well, both. That's just
pretty good. All right, well, hey, listen, this is a good spot for us to take a break. Because it's going downhill from here. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And let's just see if we can survive this half hour, guys. Hey, I wanted to bring up some questions that we had from some listeners out there. And the first one I want to bring up was Brian from Albuquerque. And Bobby, you can help us with this question. And he was he's an unpublished classical orchestral composer. And he was wanting to know about getting his music into movies and television. And Rob, you can actually weigh in on this. And he wasn't really interested in getting his music in as underscore, but in getting his music in as far as complete pieces into the movie.
Right, as a feature.
What's the path that you would take? How do you get into it? How would you break into that if you wanted to give some advice?
Well, I have to be honest, for anybody as a starting composer or classical or any style of music, it's hard to actually say, I want this music to be used only in its entirety or only as a feature. So you have to, if you do want to be part of a movie, and that's really what you're doing, composing with a film, it's 50-50. You've got to realize that you're contributing to the overall package. So you have to really make friends with that concept first. Otherwise, you really, film will be a hurtful place for you, because you'll end up being override by guys scratching their heads, and you've got an orchestral score going, and the guy's scratches his chest, and it'll be louder than your music. So you do you do have to make friends with that. So I would suggest, you know, the first bit of advice is, I would say absolutely, it's you must hold your music in the highest, you know, and want the best for it. But you really do have to realize that if you're making music and you want to be a composer for film, for TV or film, let's just say, and would like to be featured, of course, everybody would, and certainly lots of people are. But it's really hard to put that stamp down first. So I have to get that out of the way first, just to be fair to anybody. Right. I don't want to burst anybody's bubble, but that's really the case. But to answer the question specifically, if you do get over that hump, there are a lot of places that license music and are looking, researching music for music in certain styles for films, and there are a lot of music supervisors that actually search through, you know, MySpace. So I would suggest, certainly as a starting spot, very simple, cheap, free sort of thing, as I'm sure anybody else would suggest, have a little web page up on MySpace, and put five or four of your pieces of music up there, and state there, you know, I'm a classical composer. This is what I want to do. I really would love to be in the movies. Is there anything here that we can do? And really, you know, just be open. That would be the first place to start. And then secondly, there's a 411, it's called, which is New York and East Coast, New York, of course, and LA 411. And it's a pretty good resource for a lot of current. They keep it current. It's not dead links. Right. A lot of current music soups and a lot of current licensing companies and small movie places. They're always looking for music, and so I would certainly suggest that you have a look at the 411 for starters. I would certainly go to MySpace first, as a starting spot, and then look at the 411 and start making some calls and get your music certainly on some sort of electronic distribution spot where people can listen to it without having to go through a CD and then meet you, and right. They just really want to listen in their bedroom and go, okay, this sounds good, this doesn't, or whatever.
No, that's a good point. You can get out there. Now, Rob, you know, since you've done some scoring, let's get the reality factor. How hard is it to get your music out there for films and for television?
I'd say it's really, really, really hard. Like three reallys, at least.
Add two more.
I mean, the stuff that Bobby said is all true. I think we've all lived what he just described. But one of the ways I've seen people actually get their stuff used is if you can get your music used in a temp score. you know, whether a music supervisor is putting it together or the editor or whoever, if you can get your music into the hands of someone who isn't at the real high pressure critical stage in the filmmaking process, but it's just trying different ideas, and you can get them to put your music in, sometimes the client, the director, the producers, whatever, they'll fall in love. If your music is just right for a scene, they might fall in love with it, and you may make it all the way to the final mix. You've seen that happen, right, Scott?
I'll add when you finish.
Okay, that's a really good place. The people you want to go after are the music supervisors, the editors, the people who are making those music choices at a time when it's not you versus, you know, some zillion-dollar composer. It's just they're looking for cool stuff and they find you.
Scott, you're going to add?
Okay. Yeah, I've got some very strong opinions on this. Okay, first of all, I just want to clarify one thing. One of the things that I do is I'm also a sound supervisor, not a sound designer, or I'm actually both. But when I take on the sound supervisor role, my job is to come up with a soundtrack and to take dialogue, music, and effects and to come up with some cohesive soundtrack. And I just got finished doing Shoot 'Em Up, and I took out a third of my sound effects because I thought it clashed with music. And sometimes I'll actually drop a music cue because I think that it's just not saying anything or it's not anything to the film.
Right.
And my job at the end is to make sure it sounds good. Now, getting to the point of composers, because I get emails and resumes more than I know by upcoming composers that want to get into film. So,
hi. How many, just give us a number right off the, like, last month.
I probably, in a week, will probably get 20.
Wow.
And just me. And I probably get about 30 sound designers.
Wow.
So here's the thing. In an industry, there's two ways. First of all, let's start the beginning way. And that is, if you want to get into film composition, there's two actual distinct ways that I think pretty much almost the only ways. For the 90% ways. And the other 10% is the planets aligning. Okay, the first thing is to go to AFI or find young directors from film schools at USC, the places that breed the best up-and-coming directors, and propose to do music for them. Take a look at their shorts. If their shorts are great and they're going to go to festival, then you want to actually back them and you want to get a relationship because this whole industry is relationship-based. The problem with that is you can go a long time without getting paid. The other part is that the industry never likes to hire people and take a chance. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
The movies now are way too much money, and someone says, give me a chance. Why? There's thousands of you guys out there. Why should I give you a chance? But what they do is that everybody that I know, including Don Davis when I first met him, Don Davis is a friend of ours who ended up doing music for The Matrix. He was the arranger, the background guy. What you're going to want to be, Hans Zimmer has created Harry Gregson Williams, and so many composers have come out of Hans Zimmer's media ventures. What you need to be is the guy who works for the guy. Gotcha. There's a guy who's going to be out there who's doing big scores. It's not this is a business. You're going to have to go in and you have to become sponsored by somebody who is working in the business. And you hang with them, you become good, because there's no major – I'm sorry, here's the myth. Most major feature films are done by a team of composers, not one single guy. But one single guy puts his name on it, maybe writes the themes, but a lot of times because of the schedules, a lot of composers are forced to use people to help them arrange, to build out the scores.
Right.
You want to be one of those guys. You want to get in. What happens is – it's not a secret who these people are. They're all out there. Everybody knows them, the music supervisors. And they start becoming the guys. And then what happens is, through your sponsorship, the main composer is going to get two movies at once, and he can't do it because one of them is going to be a low budget with an up-and-coming director. So what happens is he says, you know what, I will godfather this project, but so-and-so is going to write the music. We'll do it together. Then also they go, I like this guy, I like his style, I like his personality, and that director grows up and becomes bigger and bigger. And that's really the way it is. And a lot of people, even to get to that point, have been in the business 10 to 12 years
Wow.
before they even get that. So the idea of come – and you also – you have to live in the place where the work is getting done.
Yeah.
You can't live in New Mexico and then try to phone it into L.A. and try to make it in. You got to move to L.A. All your friends have to be part of it. You need to know the session players. You need to know the publishers. You need to know all the sound soups. You need to know the music editors. You need to go to lunch. You need to have your whole life wrapped around this community. And then
you may not get a gig.
And you still may not get a gig. Yeah, yeah.
Well, the other thing, too, is what was really interesting is you also can't fall in love with your music to the point where there's going to be a music editor that's going to take your music and is going to do all kinds of fun
and a sound designer.
Fun and interesting things with it. So, you know, it's your music can't be too precious.
Well, we joke around with composers, you know, because I've had composers come down and, oh, my God, I can't hear the piccolo part here. I'm like, you know, if you really love the music that much, go buy the album. But the reality is in film and TV, it's not a music medium. It's a storytelling medium that music plays a role, dialogue plays a role, actors, sound design. And it's only a small piece of the puzzle that at the end becomes something. So when you do write a score, you should go to a movie or TV show and never hear the score, but walk out going, oh, my God, that was so emotional.
Right.
Because the emotion actually is carried most of the time
right.
by the music.
That was a great response there, Scott.
Oh, thank you. Other than that, I have nothing to say on the matter.
But if there is somebody, I mean, you know, I don't want to open myself up to being inundated, but I do get a lot of people sending me emails.
Bobby at
But if there are any composers, classical composers, legit classical composers that are able to do classical composition with using MIDI, if they want to contact me, I'm always looking for people like that.
What's your email address?
They can contact me at info@summerfieldmusic.com. Oh, definitely. If it's orchestral stuff, definitely. I'm always looking for talented people to do that stuff.
Well, it's very generous of you, Bobby.
Absolutely.
So thank you. That's info.
But don't send me MP3. Just contact me first, and we'll talk. And then if you need to, you can send me a link to your site.
Yes. One thing that people need to know about, whether
Please.
It's for this or any other part of the music business, unsolicited material
gets canned.
It's a bad idea. Don't send anybody your music without letting them know it's coming or asking if they want to hear it first or waiting for them to request it.
Same thing with music supervisors. I know, you know, said, oh, send stuff to music supervisors. And it'll never get through the front door. They just don't have the time.
Right. No, you need to get it to them, but you're not going to get it to them just by
like
doing
that.
Mailing it to them and saying, hey, listen to this.
Which allows us to come full circle if you have a place where they can go to you, like MySpace.
Exactly.
That makes
sure.
it the perfect
Much
thing.
Better.
And also people, it's, you know, there's a point of who you know, but the reality is, people just like helping people they like.
Well, I just wanted to bring up another question that was emailed to us. It's from Jim from Salem, Oregon. And this is pretty timely because I was having a conversation with Ken Kane, our engineer.
He's asleep.
And it kind of deals with this. And the thing is Jim was wanting to know our opinion on why it seems like success kills creativity. You look at a lot of the artists that only get like a freshman album and their sophomore, you know, album really sucks, or songwriters who have maybe, you know, a string at the beginning and then things kind of taper off. It's and I was wondering, you know, I wanted to bring it out to the table. Do you think that's true?
Yes.
I wonder why they
success definitely
you know to us.
Success hampers experimentation.
That's part of it.
I think it's not the creativity. But all those times you spent years and years experimenting at your house, trying ideas, and then you come up with something new, and then you're really successful and people love that, do you have time to experiment as much as you used to?
I think the time is the key part of that, though, is that with success comes responsibilities, just promoting your own music, if we're talking about music. And
right.
I mean, until you're successful, presumably, you might have a job that pays the bills, but every waking moment is spent working on your music, and that's all you do, and it's all you care about, and that's it. It is your life. Whereas once you have some success with it, that success becomes a huge part of your life, just sustaining the music you've already made. And I think it takes a lot of time away from when you would just sit for 12 hours at a time working on a song. Now you've got two.
Right. Well, also, it might, you know, while you're trying to become discovered and trying to work on your craft, you might spend 10, 15 years on your first album and maybe get to spend 8 months on your second one.
Right, six of which you're on tour.
Right.
But don't you also find that when you find a formula that works and that people have reacted very positively to as a musician. Because you think of, like, how many artists are out there that have a sound, but they're actually good enough to do several sounds, but this one sound seems to hit pay dirt every time. So the question is, do you risk? How many failures can an artist have before they go into the void?
Well, I mean, that's true. There's definitely a certain thing about playing it safe. But yet at the same time, you see, I don't know, you see.
But also, you know, it's, I have to jump in there, Mike.
Sure.
You know, this radio and styles change, you know, and even if we saw a great record coming out by an artist that maybe is his 15th album, it might be brilliant work, but because it's not in, you know, it's not the time, and people have shut the doors down to that kind of sound or whatever, it's, you know, times change. So a lot of, you know, some great work can get lost because people aren't looking at it because of the fashion has changed and because this band is no longer or this artist isn't thought of in that light of being the new thing on the block, you know. So, you know, it's a very tough question because I think you could speak to a lot of artists and they'd probably say, although I didn't sell so much on this album, it's my best work, you know. It's a very, just a really tough question, you know, because I think some artists have recorded some great work later on, but radio doesn't want to play them anyway because they're no longer in their, it's not their time.
Well, that's a good point because it's, you know, what one person perceives as they're going downhill, they may perceive as this is my heart actually coming out. This is what I really want to say.
And sometimes they look back and they'll say, great, gracious me, you know, this artist 10 years down the line, this is a classic album, but we never discovered it at that time because we didn't want to play him anyway, you know, and his time had come and passed, you know. You have to think a big deal about fashion and what radio and what TV and what the media wants to light up with. You know, they're not going to hold on to Jackson Browne and Joni Mitchell forever, even if they are bringing out great work. They're going to say, we have to go to the next thing.
I mean, that's an interesting, I know it's sappy, but Avril Lavigne had a very successful first album.
Right.
Sophomore album, wanted to do something more rock and roll, something a little bit harder, something to get away from the pop. Did the album, didn't do very well. This third album, she came up, she went right back to the same form as the first album. Boom! Instant success, and they're saying, look, you know, sometimes this is, it's a business too. It's not always what you want to do, but it's
well, and also, anybody's success pigeonholes them. So, I mean, there are bands like Alien Ant Farm, who are actually really talented and write some really good songs, but their hit was a cover of Smooth Criminal. And that was it. It didn't matter what they put out. They could not have a successful second single, let alone a second record. It was impossible.
Right. Well, that's a problem with your big success being a cover.
Yeah, if your success will generally come from one thing, mm-hmm. and it will be a snapshot of a tiny bit of what you do, because no one song encompasses an artist's entire range. But that's what you're known for, it's what you're recognized for, and people, I think as listeners, you like to be comfortable and know what you're going to get for the most part.
Right.
I think a lot of new artists don't understand, also, the question involves success.
Right.
I don't think a lot of new artists necessarily understand why the equation around them worked, you know, the people, what everybody did. And the problem with the new artist, when they have success, a lot of times they think they know everything at that point.
Right.
And the ego kind of takes over a little bit. And the chances of recreating that process, even if it's going to result in a very different kind of music, getting all the same people around you,
right,
the same process is really hard for a lot of people. And that's one of the main reasons why you can't follow up the way you
well,
do.
Well, even on the film side, you look at The Matrix.
Right.
The Matrix 1 was an amazing film. It set so many levels on so many fronts of creativity. And then The Matrix 2 and The Matrix 3, exactly what you were talking about, is that all the planets aligned on the first one. And the second and the third one, it lost its balance,
right,
and it was okay, but it was nowhere as good as the first one.
But it's always hard to go forward looking in the rearview mirror because, meaning to say, when everybody's had a massive hit, like an artist or a movie, they're like, "Oh, you do what you did on the first one," and then they're going back. They're not creating.
Well, they may think they're doing the same thing as the first one, but they're missing the key elements.
And the first
which
one,
they're not even aware of.
The first one they did without safety nets. It was inspirational as opposed to looking.
All you have to do is look back at Michael Jackson leaving Quincy Jones. You know, he did fine by himself afterwards, but there was never anything like Thriller again. There was never anything.
I was absolutely going to bring that up. New bands that work with a producer, and then they have some success, and then they leave that producer, and they never get that success.
Well, they want to prove that it was them. But,
and they're wrong.
Yes.
They can be. But also, then there are artists where if they can stick around long enough, I think a lot of them will actually get a second swell, and that swell is much longer lived, and it doesn't happen as often anymore, but I think the Chili Peppers is a good example.
Yeah.
They were a huge buzz when they first started because of the punk thing, and then they had their big hit with Blood Sugar Sex Magik, but then with people leaving the band and things like that, they sort of started to go down again, but managed to keep it going till now. I think no matter what they put out, they will be successful with it because they've gotten a following that isn't expecting a specific thing from them and will take whatever they get. And Radiohead is the same way.
What about
U2? U2, I think, is the same way. I think people will take anything U2 puts out and cut them so much slack in it that they can do whatever they want
to
do.
But you are also talking more about like the Chili Peppers and U2. They are real artist bands. They are creators. They're not, you know, Avril Lavigne's, no disrespect, because she's great. You know what I'm saying? They're not fabricated from the get-go.
To this point, she's been performing records as opposed to
that's exactly right.
Creating.
We don't really know what that artist is.
But I think the producer played a big part. Rick, I think, played a big part in the Chili Peppers.
Oh, absolutely.
They got a really good captain of that album.
Well, I mean, and George Martin had a lot to do with the Beatles. And, you know, you don't always have all of the pieces within your own band.
Right.
And some bands, like with Pink Floyd, I mean, as much as everybody loved Syd Barrett, him going was what propelled them to where they ended up.
But I think that's what's important is when you talk about hits, it's not always just the band. It's the team of people that it took to produce it and to create it, the engineers, the producers, the musicians, the people that you don't see. And that's really the sound. It's not just the one guy on his guitar most of the time.
Right.
It's everything that made that magical, Quincy Jones with Michael Jackson.
So do you think the success, instead of putting success, it's the ego, if we could put ego there, because it would seem to me that a lot of times a lot of this is ego driven. They want to prove that
I think maybe you can make choices because of your ego that could turn out to be bad, but no, I don't think so. I think if an artist is completely unable to have any success after their initial success, then maybe the initial success was more of a fluke.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing.
It often is just one hit single.
It's not necessarily saying that they're a bad artist and don't have something to give, but I mean, it could be the success itself, like with Alien Ant Farm, that actually prevents them from having success. Whereas if that first Alien Ant Farm record hadn't had a big single, but it sold okay, then their second album would have come out and they'd probably be building over the course of a few albums as opposed to trying to chase something.
It's so funny you say Alien Ant Farm because I picked up, you know, a couple weeks ago, I just bought their whole catalog off of iTunes because I got into it because of the their hit single. And then, this is kind of cool.
Right.
I heard some more and more stuff.
I worked on the album that the DeLeo brothers from Stone Temple Pilots produced. And it's a little all over the place, but they're really good. And they play great. He sings great. But, you know, people wanted another.
Well, what about These Days? That was a pretty decent relative hit, you know, wasn't it?
Not like Smooth Criminal.
But I think that... if you can rise to success, I think the second thing you need to do, and it sounds weird, as long as it doesn't paralyze you, and that's keep your fear. Fear is a wonderful thing because it's a great motivator. If you, the moment you think you've got it and you're there, that's a bad place to be. Meanwhile, if you remember, it doesn't take the elevator that far down to go back to where you started. And something about just never feeling right about what you do but want to try to better it.
Right.
It's a great motivator because what it does is it keeps you on your edge. It keeps you motivated to try something new, to be experimentative, to push yourself. I don't know. For me, what's hard is as a sound designer, I got to keep creating new, theoretically, things that nobody's heard. I guess similar to music. But sometimes it's like, God, what else can you do with some of this
stuff? But it doesn't have to be fear. I mean, I think it's just important to try to keep being creative instead of thinking, oh, I figured it out. I'm curious, as an artist, because we're speaking primarily about artists, but you're the one who's actually been the artist most successfully. So, I mean, does any of this ring true? Or?
I think it all does. I just think it's there's so many variations on what people class as success, you know, and that's the big thing. You know, is it a chart success or is it an artistic success? You know, there are so many different changing views on this. A person's success or an artist's success can be graded in so many different ways. You know, you can look at Stevie Wonder and his period of time of his, you know, of talking book and right from the beginning, and then they could say his later work wasn't quite so commercial or it sold as much. But this could be just totally to do with how the market's changing. It's easy for us to judge an artist and say he's not writing hit singles. Well, it's not a hit single market really at the moment. You know, it's a totally different world. The music industry is a second division industry at the moment. It's going through a really bad time, you know. So for me personally, I just think it's hard to make judgments unless we're doing something blatant and saying Peter Gabriel's not selling as many records as Sledgehammer. Well, it's, you know, I want to use a bad word for that, but I'll get beeped out. But really, he may be doing a very special work. That to him as an artist, and I'm getting back to that artist thing that is really important for him to do, and later on down the line, people will respond to that. And so for me, our conversation is based more on how many records did he sell? Have they had a hit record? And I can understand if you want to judge it that way, you say, okay, well, this person is doing much better than this person. But I think when you talk about artistry, you know, it's hard to say Joni Mitchell isn't as wonderful now as she was back then. We're remembering a different time and a different place. It was a different moment. Matrix came out at a different time. It would be hard to bring that out again and say that was old fashioned. We'd say, we've seen it a lot. So for me, I have to go down to the common denominator and say, if the artist, which is a big word to me, feels that he's doing his best work, well, he probably is. You know, that's how I see it.
Because you got to think, when an artist has made the money they wanted to make, has gotten the stature they've wanted to get, now can they have the ability to experiment in areas that may not be considered successful?
This is a really interesting thing because of Paul McCartney. You know, you go around Starbucks, and I bought the album, and I'm going like, it's okay. A lot of whistling in it, but it's okay. And he's one of my heroes. But then, you know, every time I walk into Starbucks over the last month, I keep on hearing bits of it, and I go, that's good. He's really singing well there.
Yeah.
It's that. You know, it's hard to nail down because we've seen this man release so many albums. We know him. We judge him. You know, he's consistent. He keeps on putting out records. And you have to, you know, I think that's a person you have to give a bit of slack to in a way. Just say, like, you know, live with it. Don't judge. It's because we judge it.
Well, anything
we judge it because he's done so much great work.
Anything that's truly new and original always takes a little while to find an audience because people always like what they've already heard. Right. So it's a real big mistake to judge something instantly upon hearing it, saying, I don't like that, because it might get to you after a while. You might end up embracing it later. But anything new is hard to embrace initially. That's part of the reason the music industry is in such trouble.
And it's very easy for us to go, this isn't revolution. This isn't, you know.
Yeah, he did raise the bar kind of high.
Yeah, so, but then if you try and zoom up into the sky and look at it for the first time, you go, that's a good vocal. That's a good production. This is interesting. We've already got, you know, our own definition has been made.
Yeah.
And that's where it's hard to judge questions like this.
Well, one thing that, you know, as I'm listening to everything, do you think now that, you know, success is going to be, you know, judged on a different level, especially with independent artists being able to release their own music, do you think we're going to get better work because they're not going to have the same type of pressure? And as an example, you know, we look at Roy, how, you know, from what you've told me, you know, his next album coming out is really good, you know, and it's like he had his first album, now he's having his next album, and maybe since he doesn't have to have the pressure of pleasing anybody but himself, it frees him up to allow his own success to not get in the way, you know. His creativity is starting to come forward, and maybe some of these bands that are out there releasing their own, you know, music, maybe their sophomore album isn't going to have the same type of pressures that they have on their freshman album. I mean, do you think that's the whole distribution paradigm is going to change?
Yeah, I mean, it could easily be that success from this point forward for a new artist is just going to be that they don't have to have another job to pay the rent, that all they have to do is their art. And that's it. And I think for Roy, that's exactly the case. I mean, he actually came over a little bit after the podcast, and we went through some of the songs and things like that. And all he cared about was the music. That was it. Every single thing we talked about was how to make the music better. It had nothing to do with who's going to like, because you never know who's going to like what and what's going to work and what's not going to work. And that's exactly it. And I think for him, that is success, is the fact that he can sit for 4 hours with somebody and talk about his music and then go off and work on it. That's success. Done. So in that case, success is creativity.
So, I mean, maybe we're going to see just a whole level of artistry coming out from just different people who aren't going to have that pressure but yet still be able
and
to...
And I'm sure it already is. You know, it's just with the 50 million people putting stuff out every single day, it's just hard to find.
That's true. I think the quality is going to improve just because so many people are doing it and it's so easy to do nowadays. I don't think the definition of success has changed all that much in each individual's mind. But when you have so many people who have access to studio equipment now and recording, that's why the quality will improve.
Also, it's interesting. I want to put out there the one important thing for those people that are out there. When I was young, I was with a music group, and we all went our different ways. There was a whole bunch of us, and everyone took very different, distinctive paths. And I got in the business, and I've made it my job. It's my career. It's how I pay my bills. My family relies on it. So it's become a business. And a business has certain stress levels, but there's a certain financial component as well as a large creative component. Then I look at my friends that are doing music that don't have to pay the bills but are doing it for themselves. They do it at their churches. They do it with friends. They got bands. They experiment. And all of a sudden, I look back, and there's a certain envy that I have for them.
Right.
Because there's a freedom that they still have, and they'll do like a little fair, and it is the great, it's so special to them. And I'm in a business where, while the creativity is great, there's still a business undercurrent to it.
Right.
So when you discuss what the definition of success is, sometimes success is getting the time to do what you love to do. And that's it.
Yeah, actually, email this guy back and just say, we're not going to answer this till we know what he means by success.
Exactly.
I'm too confused.
Yeah, because none of us have really got close to it.
No.
No, but it's, you know, it's, but like
he's
you guys
probably
are
talking
out,
about sales and terms.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Of course he is.
Well, because you look at the people that everybody knows and you can say, oh, well, they got successful and blew it. Right. But
no, he wants to be one of those guys living in a cardboard box under a bridge, but with real artistic integrity. That's what he's going for.
I will tell you, headspace seems to be really important. It's just where the artist is and just with themselves. I mean, and because it seems to me when you see an artist that just is in a really good space, just their life is just in a really good space, or they've accepted what you know the situation around them, it just seems you get a lot of really good work.
I don't know so much about that.
I think
the opposite.
I mean, all these successful people.
You're right. I can see that.
60s and 70s, I think, was one of the best times in music evolution in the world. And most people were out of their little trees.
Yeah, but that's like success on the way up. You know what I'm saying? Because there's all that hunger. But it seems to me that the artists that once they get up there, if they're going to keep the quality up, they just have to be, you know, in a good spot. But you're right. I as I'm talking to you, I can think of.
So I don't know. There's a pretty big list of successful troubled folk.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Yes, I mean, yeah.
Nirvana.
Well, exactly.
It goes on and on over time. I mean.
Yeah. Okay. Scratch that.
Yeah, it's an edit.
But you know, on the other side, you know, I look at, and I'm going to use Martin as another example. You know, I've heard his new album, and you know, I don't know what's going on up there in his head, but I do know that the music is definitely it's some of his best stuff, you know, as far as I'm concerned ever, and it just seems to me he's
smiling. Well, I agree with you there because I've heard his record too. It's a really great record.
Yeah.
That's sweet.
And
you know,
Pagey, Pagey and I are just a sidebar, but we send each other, you know, YouTube links every now and again, and you know, whatever. I've sent him whatever. The other day he sent me Go West. And King of Wishful Thinking. I don't know if you've heard the song.
I love that song.
It's a lovely
song.
I tell you something, and I love Go West as a band, but there's a guy on the YouTube, he just plays his acoustic guitar, left-handy player, and he sits down and plays through the chords, and he sings the song. But I love that the song comes through, and I'm like, man, that's such a better song than I even remembered it being. And I just, you know, he's a great writer, old Pagey, although he's
thank you, Bobby.
No, he
boy.
Is.
It's funny because on YouTube you find these things, and I haven't seen that video of the band doing it for years. So it reminded me, you know, of what it was back then. And then Bobby sent me straight back, I'm Not in Love by 10cc, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay.
The harmonies on that were unbelievable.
Yeah, they're all playing keyboards. They've got these mellotrons, so it's thousands of voices, but it's great.
But Martin, you know what we were saying before. I mean, you've had a level of success, and now you're. What's the fire that's pushing you to write such great music right now? You know,
cat food.
Gotta pay for my cats. Yeah. No, it's I'm in a lucky situation because, you know, a few of the songs in the past did well. And so you do get that chance to, look back and say, okay, I'm not fighting at the door. And, but, you know, you just, that's really where the title of the album came from, you know, The Temple of the Muse. It's just, you, I'm still in love with it. You know, you still love to do it. I mean, it sounds very corny, but you still can't not do it. And then you get a, maybe a second push to, and you learn some different instruments and different, you just get, you can't let go of it. And I've had this for many years, you know, so I look back and think it's, you know, I can't see myself not doing it. You know, it's something you love to do. But, you know, as we, I'm in a situation where I'm not really totally looking at it as a business, and I am releasing it on my own label. So it is an artistic venture for me now, and that's something I've never done before, and that's why it's enjoyable. I'm looking at it with less stress, with less, overheads of saying I must accomplish this. I must. It's a different record to The House of Stone and Light, and I know I take a risk on that. It's a much more of a low key record and a more it's a deeper record. So you know that some people are going to say I don't get this because I love the old record, you know. But that's the risk you take. And to be honest with you, it satisfied me, and that's all it is now. At my stage of the career, you've got to satisfy yourself. And I'm in a lucky situation. I know many people don't have that, so I feel very fortunate to say these choices are made not for buying the cat food. More about like, yeah, I'm moved by this, you know. And wow. I just feel a little bit one of those unique ones that has a chance to do something without being scared that somebody's going to say this is going to be, it should be a top 10 record, you know. And that's too much pressure at this stage.
But we are doing a remix on Saturday. We're going to put 909 all the way through. Just in case.
Well, you know, we're running out of time, but I think on that pretty much, you know, kind of sums it up. And I guess, you know, as long as you just are hungry for it, and as long as you want it, you can keep it going, you can keep it moving, you can
I think it sounds very, very noble, but I think that's why we're still sat around the table here, all of us, you know, and it's good to talk about it in that way. We do care about it, we love it, we're addicted to it, and it's become a very, you know, passionate thing to us. It's motivated us for many, many years. That's why we're sat here. And, you know, you can't, it's not all business.
Oh, anybody who does it just for the money is never going to have the success. No, it just doesn't work. You can't sit down and say, okay, now we're going to write a hit single. It just
it's very happen. Actually, it's a good point in saying that everybody that probably around this table, the people we've worked with, have been as addicted to it as we have been.
You know? Absolutely.
The money is a byproduct of the success.
The money comes automatically if the product's good.
No.
It's coming.
I haven't noticed.
Just think about the fee you're being paid to be here tonight.
Yeah, double it.
All right, on that note.
Trial Mix Plus.
All right, well, if you thank you, Jim, for taking up the rest of our time here. But if you have any questions for the panel or anybody individual, feel free to send them at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also send them on our MySpace page, and that's myspace.com/audionowcast. myspace.com/audionowcast. Rob, before we go on, you going to be working on anything interesting?
Yeah, family reunion. That should be interesting. I don't know exactly when this is going to post, but this is that summer holiday season, and I'm going to be leaving town for a much-needed break.
Well, that's good for you.
That's great. Andrew?
Well, I didn't realize we were going to be podcasting so soon again, so I'm still about to go to the Live Earth show at Wednesday.
This will probably post after you've been. How was it?
It was going to have been great.
Yeah, by the time anyone hears this, we're all done with vacations and back to being stressed out.
All right, we should let the cat out of the bag. We're pre-taping this because everybody's going to be leaving for a couple weeks, so... You know,
it's because you'll be drunk because of your birthday. That's what it is for 2 weeks.
That's what it is, yeah.
Bobby?
Oh, well, the question was... not much. I've got my music library. I've got a music library called Trailer Trash, and I'm putting the 7th CD together.
Woo-hoo. Oh, it's great.
And he's going to be watering all our plants.
Absolutely. Oh, God, I will do that with pleasure.
And don't forget to send your emails if you're an orchestral composer.
That's right.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. info@summerfieldmusic.com. So,
Scott?
July 11th, San Francisco Expression College. We are going to do the official release of the Interactive Entertainment Sound Developers. We are going to be throwing a big bash in San Francisco.
Really?
Then we are going to be throwing another big bash in L.A. We are going online in a pretty massive way, and we're getting pretty excited, and we're going to be bringing on Europe and Japan in September. So the ISD is getting ready to launch, and it's been a year in the making.
Wow.
So stay tuned, folks, and check that out. It'd be really kind of cool. And you could check out some of it at the Game Audio Network Guild. .org or something like that.
Martin.
Well, I'm with you, Mike, doing some editing for the EPK, which I'm looking forward to. And then I'm with Bobby on the weekend.
Absolutely.
Doing a bit of mastering at Bobby's studio.
Yep.
So I'm with my mates this weekend.
Then we've got to go for a little munch, aren't we?
You bet.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. A bit of footy on Sunday.
Yep, so our lives are good.
Pretty much.
That's football.
We do work, soccer. Then we play soccer.
Footy is not, you know, you guys playing footy under the table.
No, that's football.
We do that all the time.
All right, well, hey, we got to get out of here before it just gets out of control. Hey, I do want to thank Ken Kane for engineering the podcast.
Ken, wake up.
Ken, where are you, Ken?
So, thank you. All right. Well, hey, for myself and the rest of the guys, you have a good summer, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.